Welcome to the ADAA podcast on trichotillomania. Today we're talking with Dr. Nancy Cuthan, who is co-director of the Trichotillomania Clinic and Research Unit and chief psychologist in the Obsessive Compulsive Disorder Clinic at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's also an associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Cuthan, thanks for being with us today. Let me ask you, can you please explain what trichotillomania is?
Sure. So trichotillomania is recurrent hair pulling that results in noticeable hair loss. And according to our current DSM diagnostic criteria, the individual also needs to endorse that they experience urges either prior to pulling or when attempting to resist pulling, and that they experience pleasure, relief, or gratification upon pulling. And we also need to rule out that it's not attributable to any other psychological or medical etiology, and that the individual experiences either significant distress or functional impairment as a result of the behavior.
How common is trichotillomania in the general population, and are women more likely to experience this than men, or vice versa?
It's a great question. You know, it's actually a lot more common than people would think that it is. It depends upon how conservative your criteria are, but most people would say that it actually occurs with a rate of 1-3% of the general population. And the question about gender distribution, most of us believe that it's much more common in women than in men, with a gender distribution of somewhere between 8-1 to 11-1 of a female to male ratio. Now, something that needs to be said here is that very often we take our data from clinic records, and women tend to be more seeking treatment than men for problems. So that may skew it slightly. And also men can shave a head, or they can do things which can camouflage the problem. All of that being said, most of us believe it's still much more common in women.
Okay. Do we know what causes it?
You know, it's probably multifactorial in nature. Really, the short answer is that no, we really can't say we know what causes it right now. There are probably a number of different variables that contribute to it. Genetics likely plays a role. There's a study that has been done looking at twins that does show that it's more common in identical twins to have concordance for the disorder. We believe that it does tend to run in families, but there's also likely environmental variables that come into play that determine the occurrence of trich.
Is there an age that you see it typically appearing?
You know, it has a bimodal onset. So most people would say early adolescence is the most common age, but also we can see it in babies as young as 1 year of age. And often with the babies, you'll see that there may be sucking a thumb of one hand, and with the other hand, they're twirling hair. But we see a lot of adolescents coming in, early teens, right around the time of puberty.
So what else can parents look for in their children if they suspect something other than just normal twirling of hair or normal behaviors?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard because some of these behaviors are developmentally normal, as you're suggesting. So if there's patchy hair loss, if there's areas of baldness, the parent should ask the child if they've been manipulating the hair. Obviously, we would want to rule out that there are any medical causes for this, and in some cases, there could be medical disorders that could be responsible for it.
What kinds of treatments have you found have been effective?
So there are cognitive behavioral interventions, and there are medication or psychopharmacologic treatments. Most people that work in the field, either seeing patients or do research, would say that cognitive behavioral treatment is the first line treatment intervention for this disorder. That being said, in some cases where either there's comorbidity of other disorders or the disorder is really severely impacting the individual's life, medication interventions may be warranted as well.
So when is the ideal time to seek treatment, but maybe before then, how do you know when it's time to seek help?
You know, on the one hand, so say with the child, You don't want to stigmatize them by giving them a label for a behavior that may not be impacting their life. On the other hand, you don't want to wait until habits get too entrenched. So each case is a little bit individual with this. You know, I would try and understand how severe the problem is, how much distress it's causing. Say with a child or an adolescent, is it affecting peer relationships? Is it affecting studies? I'd try and understand the family dynamic, how the parents feel about this behavior. And I'd also try and understand the motivation of the individual. If either a child or an adult is not motivated to do cognitive behavioral treatment, we know that it's going to be a failure, and we don't want that to happen. So it's a lot of variables taken together that I think you have to evaluate to make that decision.
So when someone comes in for treatment, can you talk a little bit about what they might expect in their treatment?
Sure. Well, it obviously depends upon whether or not it's psychopharmacologic treatment or cognitive behavioral treatment. Given that I'm a CBT person, I'm going to talk more about the cognitive behavioral end of it. So after we do the initial evaluation, one of the first challenges that we face is trying to do what we call a functional analysis of behavior. So we want to understand what are the antecedents or the triggers to the behavior and what are the consequences to the behavior. So often I will ask an individual after the first evaluation session to take a self-monitoring log home with them, and I'll ask them when they're pulling their hair to make entries in this log to record things such as time and situation and feeling state, thoughts, associated motor behaviors, when they became aware of the behavior. After we do the functional analysis, we try to map out whether or not they're pulling in response to uncomfortable sensory experiences, whether or not it's emotional triggers, whether or not it's certain thought patterns, worry, and then treatment gets somewhat tailored to the individual. Habit reversal training, which was promulgated many, many years ago, consisting of a competing response, awareness training, some social support, that's often what we start with, as well as some stimulus control procedures, which may alter the environment in a way to make it harder for the individual to pull, to cue them when they start to engage in the pulling behavior, or to replace some of the satisfaction that they may get out of the behavior if there is a sensory or tactile, say, satisfaction that they get. After we work on those skills, very often we also try and implement as well some techniques that help the individual to develop a tolerance for some uncomfortable internal experiences. So in my own work right now, we're working on including some DBT skills as well.
And so what about relapsing? Is it common? Is it typical? In other words, if a patient goes through treatment and then finds himself relapsing, or herself perhaps I should say, what can they expect?
You know, unfortunately, relapse has had, there have been very high rates of relapse in the published studies. There was one study that in fact showed that the individuals that went through treatment had the same severity of hair pulling behavior, say a year out from their treatment, as individuals that had dropped out of the treatment. So it's something that those of us who are doing research in this field are working very hard to change. And my own feeling is that part of what has gone awry with the treatments to date is that we haven't taught individuals enough to be willing to accept that they are going to have urges for this behavior, probably throughout their life, that this will always be a vulnerability that they have. So hopefully some of the studies that are being conducted currently will show that we can tackle this relapse problem.
So what else is new on the research horizon, or what would you like to see come out of research in the future?
Wow. There's a lot that I would like to
see.
Absolutely. My wish list is huge for this. What I can say, as someone who's been in the field for about 20 years, that there's a lot that's on the horizon right now. We have people that are using novel medication agents. We have people that are working on augmented CBT strategies. We have animal modelers that are trying to come up with analogous behaviors in the animal kingdom that can help us to understand this problem in humans. We have people that are looking at brain structure and brain function in ways that we haven't looked at before. So hopefully, collectively, with the findings from all of these different streams of inquiry, that together we will get ourselves to a place where we can understand this disorder at a level that we haven't to date, so that we can start to really alleviate the suffering that these individuals go through.
That would be nice. Thank you again, Dr. Kuthin. This is Jean Kaplan-Tycro for ADAA.